Hey folks, my name is Jason Spies. I am the moderator for the Weekly Word with Professor Stephen Hines. This week we're joined with Craig Richardson with E&E Legal. That's Energy and Environment Legal. Find us some solid ground, clean this damn life up, and turn it all around.
Got lost. Hey, Craig. Hey, Jason. How are you? Thanks for joining us today, Craig. I really appreciate it. We are going to talk, without going into too much detail on myself, Professor Stephen Hines, energy columnist, the word merchant, but most importantly, we have a very important guest today, Craig Richardson, and one of the reasons we have Craig on is that he and his institute won a very important legal battle last week against the University of Arizona. I'd rather pass it through to Craig immediately for him just to give us a little rundown on the events of last week and where he stands with his legal action against the university.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for joining us here. Craig Richardson, President of Energy and Environment Legal, E&E Legal, going forward, I'm sure we'll refer as it too, but the full name, Energy and Environment Legal. Understand you did have a big case out there that was won, so let's give a little bit of a recap, maybe kind of what the overview of the case was, and then what the result was, if you would.
Sure. Well, you know, anything involved in the legal process isn't quick. This actually goes back to a Freedom of Information Act or public records request that we submitted to the University of Arizona back in 2011, which we just celebrated our sixth-year anniversary of submitting that FOIA. The genesis for this, as you probably know, coming out of the UK, at least that's where the emails were leaked through what became known as ClimateGate. And in ClimateGate, where a number of international climate scientists, UN officials, government officials, professors scattered around the globe, who was pretty clear from these emails were manipulating data, preventing other alternative viewpoints to come in as science demands, actually. They were shunning people, voting people off the island. And these were leaked by a whistleblower of sorts. And in those emails were a number of professors in the United States, one being Michael Mann, who is now infamous for his hockey stick research. And the hockey stick is essentially the vision of a hockey stick on its side, starting to the left and going back several thousand years. You can see a straight line, and then all of a sudden in early 1900s, late 1800s, you see a steep increase in temperature, and that was dubbed the hockey stick because it was easy to imagine. And that is the foundational science behind all of these onerous climate policies that we now see playing out in Europe to devastating effect, as well as to what they're pushing here in the United States with the Clean Power Plant. So our goal as a free market transparency watchdog group was to find out and drill down and get some of these emails from the professors that were identified in these ClimateGate emails. One of them was Michael Mann, and we went to UVA and went all the way to the Supreme Court in the University of Virginia and lost that case. And then we also at the same time sent FOIAs into the University of Arizona, back in 2011. And, the case has been in several courts, the regular district court, and then the appellate court, and then the Supreme Court, and then back to the appellate court. It's been a long and winding road, as the Beatles would say. But we have now won twice at the Supreme Court level in Arizona, and, you know, there are still legal recourses for the university. They are clamping down. They have been, just as UVA did. They are stonewalling. They are arguing ridiculous things, such as this information should be proprietary and we need to protect some our professors' right to research, which we're all for, by the way. But this has nothing to do with that. These aren't even, these are emails on their free time as advisory people to a UN panel. And these are also emails that have been shared extensively with colleagues and other people in the public realm. So it's not like this is hiding the secret about how they're going to cure cancer or anything. So It was a victory at the last week at the court level. We hope that at some point the judges will say, okay, enough, and just go ahead and remand that these things be released. So that's what we're hoping. I think you're going to find a very interesting roadmap into how this foundational science was actually developed, how it was done with green pressure groups who are financially vested in this whole process, how they had input into this, and how this essentially this whole scam is, how it was cooked up. And now 20 years later, when we haven't had an increase in temperature, how all this house of cards really needs to be examined very closely with objective science.
Now, Craig, as I recall, Michael Mann all along, in fact, to this day, has been claiming he hasn't revealed any of his own work, and claiming proprietary, which seems very strange. How can his participation in his formulation, how can any other scientist review it if he's keeping all of his data to himself?
Well, that's his whole point, right? I mean, if your data is flawed and it won't stand up to scrutiny, then your only recourse is to tell everybody that it's proprietary. I mean, that's been our point all along. I mean, science shouldn't operate this way. Science should be out in the open. The whole concept of scientific integrity and scientific review is just that. Here's what I think. Here's my thesis, and I'm going to let the world prove me right or wrong. I mean, that's how we get to the theory of relativity and everything else. I mean, that's how it works. And unless you're playing political science, which is what these people have been doing for 20 plus years.
And the other thing that from my observations, that somehow this work they've done with not just the environmental groups, but also with, they're all public records, essentially, which they, of course, have been arguing about things before and after them, that is the EPA, et cetera. But the EPA is sitting on an awful lot of information, text messages and what is it, IMs and all kinds of things. They've been withholding them from you all along, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, I mean, if you don't have anything to hide and you're doing things that are above board, then you don't need to hide things. And that's been, this is how government should work. And this is what we do as a watchdog group, is to try to shine light and bring transparency. But, this last administration, which is sort of ironic that he came in there and said he was going to be the most transparent in history, has been just basically shutting down any sort of correspondence and policy making out in the light of day. And in fact, we've got emails that we were finally able to get out of the EPA showing that green pressure groups basically wrote the Clean Power Plan. They had that plan in place before they walked in. A lot of the times they would meet at the Caribou Coffee across the street of the EPA because they didn't want to be officially logged. I mean, that's not what our founding fathers envisioned policymaking being.
Well, those were over 100 pages, and thank you for that work, by the way. What interesting reading, because as I recall, it shows people like Charles Driscoll and Harvard working with the EPA before, during, and after their release of that so-called indirect health benefit study.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, and for some reason, we've been asleep at the switch since the 90s, really. I mean, because, I would like to say, I don't always want to be that negative. I mean, I'm old enough, and I'm sure you all are too, to remember the lakes were on fire in Cleveland. And, we had an environmental mess on our hands, and a lot of it was cultural. I mean, we, just sort of threw things around. And so the EPA's charter in the beginning, I think, was important, and they did a lot of good things in the clean. And they had, a good, healthy discussion about what should be done and what shouldn't. And they tried to balance the interest of, I remember working on a Senate race in 1984, and we did an actual press conference with a candidate out front of a utility that had just put scrubbers on, and, they had done a lot of good work. And unfortunately, as we sat there asleep at the switch, this agency had been taken over and radicalized, and so they no longer were really primarily concerned with the safety and health and welfare of the people. They use that as an excuse, and still do to this day. But the fact of the matter is that they had a political and financial agenda that they were trying to do. They were trying to move everybody away from fossil fuels. They're trying to move everybody towards this, quote, renewable energies, of which all their big benefactors like Steyer and Rockefeller already had interest in. Al Gore himself was worth $1 million the day after he lost his presidential race, and then 8 years later, he's worth $100 million because he went into green energy grants that he got from Obama and some of the other folks. So, that's the game they play.
Craig, is there any hope we'll ever find out how, you know, the recipients of these grants and the size of these grants? Now, I know, in fact, I think it's more of your work where on the panels that were so advisory panels for the EPA, that something like 20 out of 22 had received grants that totaled like $193 million. And it was never disclosed either by the EPA or the people who were on the panels and who received this grant money. Is there any chance?
Yeah, we sued our colleague, Steve Malloy, who's actually, you know, he led the effort last year when we sued. It was KASIC, the acronym for the Science Advisory Committee for EPA. Yeah, it was ridiculous. Like, yeah, it was like 20 out of 21 or something. People were on the, quote, outside advisory committee objective look at the science, were also on the government till getting personal grants. It's a little like the pharmaceutical company basically helping the FDA regulate themselves. I mean, it stinks, and we went in there and sued and exposed this last year, and then I got our current administrator has just recently announced that he's looking at abolishing that whole practice, that if you get EPA grants, then you cannot sit on this committee. Now, of course, they're all screaming and yelling and saying how these people are trying to pollute the world because of doing this, because these are reputable scientists, but I guess I would scream and yell, too, if they just suddenly cut off my funding source. That's what they did, and then they get...
Craig Richardson, president of the Energy Environment Legal, Ian E. Legal, also Professor Stephen Hines. We're talking about a court victory that happened in Arizona that Craig Richardson's team oversaw or actually spearheaded, if you will. I didn't want to use the incorrect legal terms there. Sorry about that. But I wrote down a little bit of a note here. I wanted to kind of reset the conversation a little bit before we get into too much political minutiae. Which what I'm hearing is, I don't know if you guys ever watch the Food Network, but every now and then they have these challenge shows, and then someone will put together a deconstructed Sunday. And that's kind of what I'm hearing. It seems to me like there's been this 30-year, I wrote down 10 to 20, but when you said the 90s, that's now we're talking 30 years. There's been a 30-year kind of orchestration to create this science of environmentalism, in which we're finding out, and I've interviewed some people in the past, several scientists who got ostracized from the scientific community because they opposed the groupthink that was happening. They didn't think the climate change was as catastrophic as what the 1,200 chosen scientists did and a few other things along those lines. But and what I'm hearing is that you're kind of deconstructing this Sunday that was created over the last 30 years, Craig?
Yeah, I was, when I first took this job over in 2013, I was driven for the first couple of years of why. I mean, none of it made sense. I mean, why would you go and destroy the most effective, efficient energy system ever created by mankind? And not only that, energy, access to cheap, affordable energy is a way to get everybody out of poverty. That's the universal poverty plan. And why would you replace that with something that basically doesn't work? I mean, wind and solar, you're never going to run LA on wind and solar. It'll never happen. It's inefficient. And it's got its own, and there's no such thing as net neutral energy sources. I mean, wind requires manufacturing and there's metal involved and it kills birds, and solar as well. And solar's, I mean, it's great if you live, got some cousins in Puerto Rico now that have some solar panels and they're very happy. So there are certainly places for that, but why would you take what is a perfectly efficient system and destroy it, essentially what they did? And so I was driven by that, and I started more, I'm also a historian in my other world, and I did. I saw exactly, I would sort of pinpoint a little bit earlier than the early 90s, that's when it sort of became more in the implementation phase. But we found that the Rockefeller Foundation, for example, back in the 80s was pushing global warming at this time. And whenever they're involved in something, you know something's up. And so that's where this narrative, and then Hewlett-Packard and some of the other, actually, ironically, some of the early environmental foundations and people that were in it were also and still are big population control people. So there's this sort of very dark agenda that was also at play here. But these people generally wanted to focus and take over and control what is a next year health, probably the most important element we have in a society, and that's energy. And they wanted to control it. And so they were a number of what very good environmental groups, like the Sierra Club, and I remember growing up, and they were sort of the blue chip type of thing, and John Muir, their founder, had a vision of protecting the natural resources for the current generation and generations to come. It was like Theodore Roosevelt had that same conservation mentality. Thank God, he's now with beautiful parks in this country. I grew up in New England, and the National Seashore took locked down most of Cape Cod. You know, it's now a crown jewel of our country. Great, all for that. But they radicalized that movement in the 90s based primarily on support they got from some of these big foundations like Rockefeller and other ones. And it's at that point that they started also turning those Sierra Clubs of the world into mercenary forces, giving them humongous amounts of money. I mean, we get hit for, you know, some small grant we got 5 years ago from a fossil fuel company, and they are getting $100 million a year in foundation money. So, you know, there's this sort of false narrative out there that that they are somehow squeaky clean, yet foundations, personal foundations and family foundations with clear political and financial agendas have been streaming money into these people. And we saw that not only take over the external green pressure groups, but then they started getting their people in place. They started putting people in the government. And I have a former colleague who's no longer with us. He's with us, but he retired. He spent 33 years in the agency. At the EPA, he said in the early days, you know, 25% was sort of moderate to conservative, and the other 75%, yeah, they tended to be left of center, but they all got along, and they all sort of had this overarching goal of health and environment together, and that's all changed. And we saw that radically change when President Obama ran for office, promising that he was going to destroy, or he used the word bankrupt, the coal industry in America. Coal at that time was 45% of our nation's grid, and he, you have run candidate running for office saying he's going to destroy that industry. And after his 8 years, that industry lost 93% of its net worth. Now, the irony is it's still a third of our energy source, and you need to ask yourself, why are all these people out of work, yet it's still a third of the energy? Well, what they did was they shifted it over. People bought up, these hedge funds and others bought up the stranded assets. It's still an important part of our country. They just destroyed Appalachia, and now somebody else is making some money off of it. So you can see this game is pretty intricate. And wild and woolly, sort of speak.
Well, and as you know, Craig, I've been, I guess I've been doing energy and broadband, especially, which becomes important now that we're really talking about the Internet of Things. And what I refer to is two sides of the same face. One is efficient energy, that is, from the ground to how it's used, and then energy efficiency, which is how it's used after the meter. And thinking about allowing a single agency to take over the waters of America and the electrical grid effectively, as you know, has driven me crazy, especially given their lack of expertise.
Well, they don't care about that because they don't have it. They're not looking at the best interests of the common person. They're pushing, as I said, a financial and political agenda, and. You know, and unfortunately, and we've been at odds with ExxonMobil. My colleague has put a proxy. I was down there last May, and they've now completely bought into climate. And every other slide was about climate. And everybody's asked, you know, ExxonMobil is the number one fossil fuel company in the world. Why would they say bad things about fossil fuel? Well, because it's these climate policies are barrier to entry, and if they go into place, they will swamp the small and independent petroleum producers. And who's there? Who's the only one can afford big government? Well, it's a corporation like ExxonMobil. And so now you're seeing they put a pro-climate person on their board last year. And I mean, I've seen this game played out before in Washington. I mean, you get industry leaders getting in bed with government and basically welcoming regulation that keeps other in other competitors out. And that's part of this game too. So there's a lot of very powerful players involved in this right now.
Well, and let me just extend that for a second, this whole late battle over net neutrality. I was involved in it directly back in 2000, 1999. It was called open access, and back then it meant something. Now, it simply means nothing. And to help explain why it means nothing, the three largest internet companies in the world, Amazon and Apple and Facebook, were in favor of net neutrality. Why? Because it took many of the players out of the game and just left more for them.
Yeah, no. Unfortunately, it's not just energy. It's not just internet. It's across the board. We're seeing the corporatization of America, really, and they're working hand in glove with big government, big business, working with big government. Essentially, I mean, we used to say when I first got into government and politics that the small business was the economic engine of America, and unfortunately, that's in jeopardy now because we have. I mean, look at the media itself. I mean, I always refer to now the. I will never use the word mainstream when describing the media because they're not. I refer to them as the corporate media because 93% of Americans get their news from one of six corporations, all of which, by the way, their parent companies have vested interests in the government, you know, various elements of the government, Westinghouse, for example. You know, it's a scary time we're in, and we see these things not just in energy, but we see them across the board now.
Craig Richardson, president of the Energy and Environment Legal, E&E Legal. Professor Stephen Hines, I wanted to interject here real quick with just a couple notes here with kind of what you were talking about. One of the things about with the media, obviously it's my realm, so I'm somewhat familiar with it, is the big three, the big four, if you will, if you want to include the cable news and all these other things. But essentially you have four major news networks and their subsidiaries. And it's a big planet, yet they all talk about the same topics. And not only do they all talk about the same four to five topics, 90% of it's speculation based on 10% of news. It's remarkable, really, when you think the planet, it's a big planet going on, and there's a lot of innovation and a lot of things happening. I mean, just the things that we're talking about right now, obviously, I think has a little bit more interest than the same four stories over and over again, but it's a big planet. So, I mean, to me, that's all the evidence that you guys really need to see that the media is more here to control a narrative for everybody as opposed to information. Just what do you think on that?
Yeah, I would agree 100%. I'm, you know, again, old enough to remember when you had three channels, right? ABC, CBS, NBC, and then you had your local UHS channels, which played things like Gilligan's Island. And so we thought, oh, great, look how wide and open now. We have the internet coming along. We have cable television. And I remember when ESPN was first launched, it was great. We've got basketball from across the country and football games and from Iowa State. You never would have. So we all thought that was great. And I think there was that period of time, you know, and even with Google, I remember doing a whole ton of research about a decade ago on Google, and it was wide open, and their algorithms are based on page hits, basically. So if something was popular, that page got to the top of the organic search. And to see what they've done in the last 10 years, like you said, I mean, they've consolidated these media. They're pushing the same message. I remember seeing something on Jay Leno, actually, where he did something innovative. I can't remember what it was, but he literally had a two-minute clip of every local news anchor saying the very same lead-in about his show that night. It was like verbatim. And it's what you said. It's like, oh, my God, I mean, this is almost, I would say it's almost like a script. This is a script. I mean, where's the creativity in America? Where's the alternative viewpoint? I mean, Twitter, I guess a week next Monday, is going to start kicking people, deplatforming people because they don't fit their terms of service. And their terms of service essentially are things that we used to pass as free speech and opinions, but now since they don't agree with them, they're going to deplatform you. And Google does the same thing. That same Google that I used to use as an independent researcher, the algorithms are all changed. I mean, you plug our group in and you get all these lefty groups that have called us all these horrible things. That's the first six things you see on the page.
Well, and I do Google alerts every day, Craig. So I have 40 or 45, and so greenhouse gases, climate change, emission trading. Of course, I follow fracking and And frankly, one of the reasons why I've become so interested in North Dakota, and if you've not been there, you should really let Jason, because Jason has access to the governor, he has access to everybody who does things in and around all of these issues about new energy and pipelines. But it's been a kind of a marvel to watch a small state that actually knows each other's name and work together on things. And to me, they're kind of a shining star out there, given the fact that even places like Pennsylvania or Ohio, they are so highly politicized. West Virginia, who's run out of coal jobs, and they're still fighting over pipelines.
Well, and I've heard great things about North Dakota. I haven't been there. I've been to South Dakota. A very close friend of mine is from South Dakota. I know that they're very different. And but no, that's a great American success story, which they tried to shut down. I mean, they didn't like it,
and they went on by themselves, and they had no federal supervision for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, it's funny how great people can prosper until the government shows up.
It brings me back to one point, and it centers around federal regulation of energy versus state. In the states, they've done a great job for 85 years. Frankly, I go to all the national utility conferences, but the thing that separates them from the federal government is the states have, not only do they have environmental groups and utilities, but they have consumer groups. So in some ways, it sounds like it's more complex, but the truth is the consumer groups keep the prices honest, and they keep big utilities or energy from getting control of the utility commissions, because they have to answer to these consumer groups who are trying to protect the end user.
Yeah, I've seen that definitely works in some states. You're also seeing overall, that's been from the very beginning. I was at his confirmation hearing, Scott Pruitt, and he's from Oklahoma, former attorney general, who sued the EPA on a number of occasions. I mean, that's his big mantra is federalism. I mean, he's trying to rein that back in and turn the power more back over in terms of the EPA. I mean, think of the EPA. In the beginning, the federal EPA in Washington was really supposed to be an advisory committee, and then they set up 50 small EPAs essentially around the country, and they were supposed to work with the states. And they took the input from the states, and most of the staff was in their regions. The EPA, I think, has 10 regions. But again, in the last 20 years, that's totally changed. Now, instead of being sort of their big brother advising them about certain energy things and sharing information throughout the 50 states, they suddenly started coming on from on high with these regulations saying, you will do this, you will do that. And an EPA, a local DEQ, and Washington State has far different environmental needs than they do in environment than in Vermont, which they do different in North Dakota, which is different than Florida. I mean, each one of those is unique in themselves. And like you said, you keep it to the local level, and they're going to know better. They're more vested in the community.
I'm gonna jump in here. I'm gonna hang on here, Stephen Hines. I'm gonna jump in here. This is a good time to mention that what Craig Richardson is talking about is a great example. What just happened in North Dakota? I interviewed Terry O'Clair last week. He's the Air Quality Division Director for the North Dakota Department of Health, and they just issued the Davis Refinery, the first refinery in 50 years built in the United States, which is going to set the standard for new environmentally clean refineries. And Terry O'Clair, they're in a public hearing period right now, but they got the permit, so if everything goes as okay over the next 45 days with the public hearing, then they'll go to the next step. And what he said is that they folded in the EPA right away. And the reason was that, you know, this is going to set the global standard. So they wanted to make sure that, you know, there was a few more chefs in the kitchen, so to speak, on something as important as this. But they drove the show. The EPA did not drive the show. He was very descriptive in his language that North Dakota was the one that had the final say, and the EPA was just here as an advisory big brother type role. So the reason I bring up that story and I kind of interject at that time is I think you're starting to see that flip switch a little bit, Craig, like you were talking about. North Dakota generally, you know, we're trust me, in North Dakota, the Tea Party in Western North Dakota, the Tea Party is liberal. So, I mean, we're quick to take that back over.
That's good to hear. I'm glad to hear that there's still those pockets. And yes, like I said, it's a great story to hear that, and I'm glad to hear that is coming back. And that is really starting with Scott Pruitt, who, like I said, I mean, the best choice for the EPA administrator, because he came out of a state, Oklahoma, big, as you know, oil and gas state, you know, like North Dakota, extremely important in our energy grid and in our energy system. And he knew, firsthand what he had faced as an attorney general and what his own DEQ had faced from the EPA over the last 15 or 20 years. And that's been, like I said, his primary talking point is that we're going to go back and, like you said, flip the switch. We're going to go back to what it was, because that's what America, and honestly, it goes back to the Constitution. It goes back to the sense that in the beginning, the federal government was only supposed to do treaties and provide national security, and then everything else was supposed to be done in the state level. And that's the whole concept of federalism in the first place.
Well, and really, when you look back at the EPA, it was started by what I call the most liberal president we've had in a long time, Richard Nixon. I mean, when you look at the things that Nixon did, he was actually a pretty liberal, progressive president with his healthcare thoughts and the EPA. But he was smart enough to understand that, you know what, there is a need for an environmental protection agency at a federal level. I mean, and at that time, the Republican Party was not keen on adding divisions at a federal level. But like you mentioned earlier in the interview, I mean, we had lakes on fire.
Yeah, there's no question that when we got to that size and industries, you know, in some cases doesn't have a great history. And yeah, and I grew up in New England, as I said, and we had some of the Superfund issues going on up there. Lowell, Mass was one, and there was one in New York, Love Canal. So there's no question that the problem with anything that started at the federal government is that it never, you know, it's like the green blob. It never doesn't know when to stop, and it just keeps going and going and going. I think we still have the measurements and weights division or somewhere, and it's been around for 200 years. You can't get rid of it. I mean, we got digital calculators and digital weighing systems, yet we still have this antiquated agency around. So that is a problem. And the other problem, but I don't think it would have been it wouldn't have had as much of a mission creep. And if it wasn't for a concerted effort by some of these large groups I've already talked about, these family foundations, who literally saw it as an opportunity when we were asleep doing other things, and really just infiltrated both externally and then internally into the agency. And whoever thought, and I remember the 80s and 90s as well, whoever thought that the EPA would have emerged as the most controversial and most economy-killing agency out there. I mean, you would have thought the IRS maybe, or, you know, one of the other ones, but the EPA, and that's what they did. I mean, people were looking the other way, and then they took it over.
Well, can I get
and then Scott Pruitt, by the way, has a really tough job. Scott Pruitt has a very difficult job, because there are career people that have been in there, and I've talked to some of the staff, and they said it's like going to war every day. I mean, they don't know where the arrows and slings are coming from.
I'm sure that's true. I have a little vignette to tell you. Back when I was working for this energy efficiency manufacturing company, I got very involved in Washington, but also with the European Union when they were trying to formulate their emission treaty. And I had a meeting with them, Lisa Jackson, which I think was about 2009. Anyway, I went in there and I said, you know, you've got these green awards, and you have companies, you know, that tell you that they save this much energy, they do this renewable, but you won't let them use it for anything other than an award that has no value. Why don't you let these companies, if there is going to be some kind of carbon tax or emission trading or whatever, if you don't allow them to use those credits for that trading, if you don't include energy efficiency into any trading platform or new infrastructure, you know, it's never going to succeed. I belonged to the Chicago Climate Exchange for 8 years until it folded. And I have to tell you, what's happening in Europe right now is that the nightmare I saw coming.
Well, yeah, they can't sustain that. And now some of those countries are going away from all these green restrictions or regulations because they can't afford it. I mean, Germany's gone back to coal. You can't afford it. And I do think that we are hopefully, you know, again, we've got success stories like North Dakota. I do think we're starting to turn the corner now. At the same time, you've also got big corporations like I mentioned, ExxonMobil doubling down on climate. So it is going to be a battle, but I do believe that every day that goes on, New York's not underwater like Al Gore said it was going to be 5 years ago. You know, that we're ultimately, because in the end, regardless of what you're talking about, the truth ultimately wins out in the end. And there may be a lot of carnage in the process, and I think we're going through that, but I do believe that, you know, that we will, you know, we will come out of this, and we will have more success stories like North Dakota and other places where, you know, and that was a big, big push for Trump. That was what he ran on, that he was going to, you know, restoring the energy industry in America and making America great again was going to start with doing things in our own country to make us independent.
Professor Stephen Hines, Craig Richardson, president of NE Legal, with us here, wrapping up our weekly word. Kind of just some final comments, some final thoughts, if you will. I'd like to kind of center it around what's next for the energy industry. What are we going to take away from this, and how are we going to use this information going forward? Because I do look at this really as a deconstruction of a 30-year Sunday of a religion of environmentalism. You know, when you mentioned the Al Gore, you know, with the water under, or with New York underwater, the first thing I thought of was, wow, okay, we're getting into the book of Revelations now, where you got to put, you know, the big fear into somebody's mind in order to, you know, get the masses going. But then you have to go back to the Old Testament and say, okay, once Moses parts the Red Sea and brings you to the Promised Land, are you going to follow the golden calf, or are you going to actually follow the man of action? Are you going to follow the person of words, or are you going to follow the person of action? So there we go. I balanced out my religion of... Craig, I've been calling climate change a religion for about 10 years because... To me, I'm not a catastrophist. I'm not. I look at, the climate's changing, but like I've said for 10 years, one volcano goes off, and that equals 10 generations of mankind spewing out as much carbon as they possibly can. So, and then I go into the old George Carlin, the great philosopher George Carlin, about we're kind of arrogant to think that humans can impact the planet like that type of a thing. But what I'm getting at, I'm not a catastrophist, and I do believe the climatology has created a religion, and it's based on what you said. Every day that we're not underwater, New York's not underwater. Hey, you know, it's another day, not to the book of Revelations, so to speak. So anyway, I kind of wanted to just kind of theme on that a little bit as far as the deconstruction of that 30-year Sunday that you talked about that's been going on. So how do we use what happened last week with E&E Legal, your firm, towards the oil and gas industry going forward, that sort of thing? Very long-winded question. I apologize.
No, that's fine. And I actually, it's funny because it is a religion. There's no question about it. And Al Gore is their high priest, and they've got their sacraments, and they've got the whole thing. And it's also in that way, in the sort of the negative side, which can be sometimes portrayed, in that people are not willing to look at anything. I mean, they are so invested in this that they get offended when you try to tell them otherwise. And we're seeing that not only with energy, but with everything that Trump does. I mean, he can't even, I saw them attacking him today for having 12 Diet Cokes in a day. I mean, there's nothing the guy can do. To answer your question, yes, this is a deconstruction. This is trying to peel the onions back, to use another analogy. And this is to try to show how this whole thing was built. How this Sunday was built. What does the ice cream underneath look like? And we've tried by showing some of the big players, you know, at the top with Steyer, Rockefeller, Bloomberg, some of the other ones, and then the middle layer of the Sunday with the green groups that are clearly doing whatever the bidders want them to do, the number of lawyers that are going along. So I think one of the things that we could do is, and we haven't gotten the emails out, by the way, we're still struggling. I mean, we won the court decision, but now, you know, they're coming in and trying to stop the process. So we still need to get these emails out. People need to be informed. We need to somehow continue to allow these ostracized scientists who've been saying, no, this stuff isn't working. And now, not only they were saying this starting in the 90s, but now we've got 20 years of satellite data proving them completely false, that every one of their narratives, every one of their catastrophes, like you said, every one of their end doomsday scenarios is wholly overstated. And that what we're seeing is, not surprisingly, a cycle that goes on. And as I think of the other comedian was, Sam Kinison used to scream his answers. You know, I feel like screaming. It's not CO2. It's the sun. That big yellow ball in the sky that can give you first-degree burns. That's usually has more of an impact on the temperature than anything.
And Professor Hine, any final thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I continue to hope that more and more people become aware of this what was a sleepy giant that is now sort of taking on the lead for new energy, and that is North Dakota, that is Texas. I'm hoping with the work of Jim Willis out in the Marcellus and the Utica, that we are reaching a point right now where the arguments don't work anymore. One of the problems is half the states have natural gas and oil and half don't. So, you know, it's hard to get a majority when you have haves and have-nots broken out like that. But I want to say that the more we focus on the job for creation, the capital formation, the advancing technology, dispelling the notions of cataclysm around every corner. And I think, as Craig said, I think even Europe is starting to wake up a little bit. There's an agreement that was signed a few days ago taking advantage of Israel's natural gas, of all things. They carved a deal with Turkey and Greece and Crete, and they are building the longest underwater pipeline in the world to provide them with natural gas. What does that do? It gives Israel a power of its own. It's offshore. They have a lot onshore. We don't know what will happen there, but offshore they have plenty. They have plenty of gas and oil to harvest. The EU realizes that unfriendly nations are going to use their supply of natural gas and oil as a political instrument and a club from time to time, as they've had to face with Russia. So I just think from the practical side, I mean, Craig and his men are doing such important work, but that's only part of it. They're helping us expose the half truths, but we have to provide the evidence that not only was it cooked in the wrong way when they did all of these environmental rules, but oh, by the way, we have a chance to take more control over our own future if we continue to harvest in places like North Dakota.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Craig Richardson, president of E&E Legal, Energy and Environment Legal. Do you have a website or any sort of contact information that you give out to the public?
Sure thing. Thanks. It's pretty straightforward. www.eelegal.org.
Easy enough. eelegal.org. And whenever I hear ORG, I just have to assume that you guys are always open for donations and silent and public philanthropists, that sort of thing. So how about a quick 30-second plug for your organization's donations?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yes, we are a C3, a nonprofit, and we do exist on the generosity of our donors, and that's how it keeps the lights on. So yeah, anybody that there is a donate now page button on the site. So yeah, thank you.
Well, and they have been true crusaders. If you go to the website, Jason, you'll understand the length and depth and the work they've done. And it's the micromanagement of a colossus, and they have done a remarkable job.
And once again, that was Professor Stephen Hines, Craig Richardson with E&E Legal, and of course, my name is Jason Spies. I'd like to thank you folks for joining us this week on The Weekly Word. For more Weekly Words, visit our website, thecrudelife.com. That's thecrudelife.com. There we've got links to Craig Richardson with E&E Legal and Professor Stephen Hines as well. Thank you very much for joining us this week. We'll see you next week with The Weekly Word. The music on today's program is written and performed by the Moody River Band. To find out more about the Moody River Band or their music, visit our website, thecrudelife.com, and click on the Musician tab. That's thecrudelife.com, and click on the Musicians tab.
Now we're gonna have no trouble with the treble. There's no breaks in the bass. It's just you and me, baby, singing it like we did in the good old days. Yeah, we're singing it like they did in the good old days, because we're back to the way. Back to the way. Oh, oh.